You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, as we wrap up our final week of live broadcasting in 2016, the great Digby, Heather Parton, proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo, columnist at Salon.com. Also on the program today, meet America's soon-to-be neo-Nazi allies.
I just see the uniforms. It's just crisp.
Syria talks begin. U.S. not invited. And it turns out that FBI warrant that James Comey issued after telling the country that there was new serious evidence was a totally bullshit warrant. And what becomes of Donald Trump's private security force now that it's not going to disband?
It becomes many things. Trust me.
Does Chuck Schumer get it? Can he get it? Doubt it. And criminal charges versus two state of Michigan emergency managers, plus as a result of the Flint poisoning. And that could not be all, folks. Trump's assault on the commons has begun, and the Klepto Watch federal procurement may go back to those wheeling-dealing days of the Bush administration, which brought to you the arms and the dudes.
I was thinking more like the Batista era in Cuba.
Meanwhile, Obama bans drilling in parts of the Atlantic and the Arctic. Courts will have the final say if Congress doesn't get there before them. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. This story coming out of Michigan. And as you know, I will be headed to Michigan for the holidays. Well, not really. I'm not going to Michigan for the holidays. I'm going to Michigan for the holiday. Just so happens that Hanukkah is celebrated at that time, too. I would not normally go to Michigan for Hanukkah, but I will be this year. Nevertheless, I wonder if this will be a topic of conversation. It will be at some of the places we go in Michigan. Others, not so much, my guess. This is getting a little too personal. This is good news. This happened last night. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, announces that there are criminal charges as a result of the process in which Flint, Michigan's water was poisoned. And the criminal charges are being brought against two of the emergency managers. And I should say, just to remind people, Michigan passed a law that said that the governor could essentially take over various cities by installing a non-elected city manager. Just a bureaucrat by the state to run the city, effectively sidelining the city council and the elected mayor. That law was repealed, if I'm not mistaken, by Michigan voters. And then they reinstituted it, Republican-controlled legislature. In the wake of that, the city managers of Flint, Michigan, went on to, in an attempt to save money, supposedly, to disconnect from the Detroit city water that they had been receiving for, I don't know, maybe how long? Decades in Flint. And while they were building a new system to get water more cheaply, they were drawing water from the Flint River. And because they had no experience in treating this water, the water, because of the maybe the heavy metals in it, I'm not quite sure what, I understand about the pipes, but whatever was in the water caused the pipes to corrode. Now, usually you have to treat water that comes from these sources to keep the pipes from corroding. And these are old pipes and lead pipes. And so lead leached into the water. And despite the complaints of citizens in Flint, despite research done by outside researchers that there was lead in this water, there was no response. Because, of course, as an appointed city manager, you don't respond to citizens. You respond to your boss, Rick Snyder, the governor. However, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schwett, again, Republican, has charged two former state of Michigan emergency managers, Darnell Early and Gerald Ambrose. Let's hear him tell us.
Very evident during the course of this investigation has been a fixation on finances and balance sheets. This fixation has cost lives. This fixation came at the expense of protecting the health and safety of Flint. It's all about numbers over people, money over health.
And that's exactly right. And Bill Schwett sounds like a guy who's going to run for something relatively soon. But basically, and the charges centered around the way in which the false pretenses in which both city managers engaged in securing loans to get this work done. There was also two other people who were charged, who worked for the water treatment plant. There were two guys, Croft and Johnson, allegedly pressured employees of the Flint water treatment plant to get the plant working in order before April of 2014, this scheduled date for restart. When the deadline closed in, rather than sound the alarm, these consultants, the defendants allegedly ignored warnings and test results and shut off the pipes, pulling clean water from Detroit and turned on the Flint River valves. In other words, we have an edict. This is Howard Croft and Doherty Johnson. We have an edict from the governor to save money, and we're going to do that at all costs. And here comes, this is Andy Arena and Schwett. These are both investigators. Andy Arena is the chief investigative officer, and Schwett's the AG. And it sounds like they're not done. And I can tell you, I have a story here from CBS Detroit. And there's only about six names in this. Andy Arena's name's in this piece. Bill Schwett's name is in this piece. Those are the people invest. I'm sorry, there's seven names. And then there's Darnell Early and Gerald Ambrose, the two city managers who were charged. And those the two, Croft and Johnson, the two consultants. And then there's one other name in this piece. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but it's Rick Snyder. Take it away, Attorney Generals of the state.
Today you see, once again, the investigation has continued to go up and to go out. As the Attorney General said, we're much closer to the end. We are the beginning, but we're not at the end. There is investigation that's still continuing today. There are some people out there right now who know that they've done wrong, and they know we're coming after them. They're not going to have a very Merry Christmas. I don't feel bad about that. But we will continue to follow the evidence. We will continue to investigate this. We owe it to the people of Michigan, and we owe it particularly to the people of Flint.
We just take them as we find them. And the fact is that this is a higher level of responsibility. These are governor-appointed emergency managers that we're charging today with 20-year felonies, and it's serious. And it, as Andy Urena said, it's we're going up. And we're going broader. And again, I've said this before, nobody's on the table, nobody's off the table. There's no, we're not out to nail anybody. No mind, if you've done something wrong, then you ought to be worried.
I suspect things at Governor Snyder's mansion are not going to be so comfortable during the Christmas holiday. I mean, up and out, getting closer to the end than we are at the beginning. No one's off the table. I mean, Rick Snyder, let's face it. These guys are facing 20 years each. They were executing Rick Snyder's plan. This guy should be going to jail. And when he gets to jail, he should be very thankful that he got jail as opposed to the incredible pain that he's going to cause. It's going to be multi-generational pain. And this is the fundamental problem you have with these city manager, these emergency manager laws, is there's no way for the people who are suffering to even have any redress. There's no leverage that they have. They call the city manager's office. City manager doesn't need to take their phone call. Doesn't care. Why would he? Completely incentivized to not listen to the population. In fact, that's the primary feature. When you privatize things, and that's all you're doing here on some level, right? I mean, it's a government function, but you're totally undemocratizing it. It is so that there is no accountability to the voters, so that there is no accountability to the citizens. And, you know, we're going to see a lot more of this in just about every facet of our government, particularly on a federal level, but surely on a state level going forward under the Trump administration. So good. I hope we, and we're going to hear a lot more, I think, from state attorney generals too, frankly. I am going to Michigan. I guess both these stories are both about Michigan.
Yep.
One's about Flint. The other one is about when I contemplate going to Michigan for the holidays, I no longer knee-jerk say, I'm not going to shave. I actually now am contemplating shaving because of Harry's. And not only am I contemplating shaving just out of, you know, some measure of, I guess, I don't know, I get this drilled in my head by my grandma that it's like a sign of respect, which is not to say that when I didn't shave, I was trying to be disrespectful, but
maybe.
I just didn't feel like I needed to, you know, put on
hello,
airs.
In-laws, I have a big beard.
Well, it's, I also, let's face it, when I haven't shaved for a couple of days, I start to look a little more shtetl, and that's always a nice thing to have. Now,
your words, not mine.
Right. And I don't think people pick up on that so much actually at the,
oh, well, maybe not in Michigan.
Right. Exactly. Honestly, I don't think they do. Are you from Serbia? And
your family wore from home.
But I also, if I shave, it's a great little conversation piece with my brother-in-laws. Because I've given them, I shouldn't say.
Don't blow it.
Just in case they listen.
I'm sure they're not.
They're not. But the holiday thought starter, I should say, the holiday shave set is a great deal. And if you enter the code Majority Report at checkout, you get $5 off it. If you haven't heard of Harry's before, it was started by two best friends, Jeff and Andy, who were fed up with being overcharged for razors. So they started their own razor company to give people what they deserve, a great shave at a fair price. This holiday, Harry's has a ready-to-gift shave sets at all different price points, starting at some at just $15. Come with a razor handle of your choice, shaving cream, replacement blades, and a travel cover. Their Winston set includes an engravable chrome handle if you want to add a personalized touch. Like I said, go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com to get a holiday shave set. Don't forget to enter code Majority Report at checkout for $5 off. That's harrys.com, code Majority Report. All right, quick break. When we get back, the great Digby.
Gonna be some trouble. A whole house will need rebuilding, and everyone I love in the house will recline on an analyst couch quite soon. Your father cracks a joke and in the usual way empties the room. Tell all of my friends I don't have too many, just some raincoated lovers, puny brothers, Dallow Spicer, Pinky Cubans, Rush to Danger, Wind Up Nowhere, Patrick Doonan, Raised to Eight. I'm tired again, I've tried again, and now my heart is full. Now my heart is full, and I just can't.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Is that the Smiths?
Morrissey.
All right. Well, we're going back. What's old is sadly new again in many respects. But ladies and gentlemen, we are now at the end of 2016. Didn't necessarily work out the way we wanted it to. But nevertheless, whether it was a great year or a not so great year, it's always a pleasure to welcome back to the program the great Digby to look back on it and look forward to the next one. Heather Parton, the blog Hullabaloo, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Sam. Good to talk to you.
2016 did not work out as well as we had hoped.
No. I would say that may be the understatement of 2016.
Well, there you go. I think understatements are going to be in... well, I mean, it's quite possible we're going to be understating a lot of things going forward. And, you know, it's always a treat to talk to you, Digby, but I think probably in terms of people who regularly come on this program, I think I've probably spoken to you the most and for the longest period of time, or I should say, we were talking during the probably the first Bush administration, maybe the second term, but I'm not quite sure. But we've been down this road before. It's a little bit weird to return to it, isn't it?
Absolutely. I really didn't think it would it would go down that way. I mean, it didn't feel like it would in any case. I thought that maybe You know, it's always a back and forth. There's a pendulum that swings, whatever, you know, in politics. But this wild swinging that we've been watching, you and I, over the past decade or decade and a half, is, you know, I mean, it's leaving me feeling pretty nauseous.
Right.
It's very, very difficult to kind of grasp what's going on. And this swing is so violent that I think, like many people, I'm still having a hard time wrapping my mind around exactly what this means.
Well, I'm not quite sure that we're going to know in many respects for a bit. But let's. I want to touch. I don't feel like we need to litigate the various reasons as to why Clinton lost. I think there's broad agreement that there's a lot of different factors. And
right.
And I also think that, you know, there's a good argument that things shouldn't have been close enough that any one factor, small factor, could have made the difference, but it did. And certainly, I think if you, you know, according to people like Nate Silver, the James Comey announcement that they were reopening or not reopening or whatever that vague implication of that announcement was about, that was taken as like, we found new evidence. There's reason to open up the case again on the, I don't know, the private email server. I guess it was yesterday, the warrant that was issued after that announcement 2 days later was brought to light by a FOIA request. And the warrant looks like absolute garbage, apparently.
Well, that's what the legal experts say, and I mean, this is like across the board. I haven't read anything. Maybe they're out there. I don't read everything that's written, but nonetheless, I've not read any legal experts saying, "Yeah, this is a good warrant." You know, lots of probable cause there. I mean, it was very strange. And you know, setting aside the implications of whether or not it was the deciding factor in the election, the fact that it happened at all should be deeply,
right,
deeply concerning to Americans. The fact, you know, even if Clinton had won, this should have been deeply, deeply concerning to all Americans. The you know, this was a longstanding norm within the law enforcement community, specifically with the FBI and the Department of Justice. In fact, we had a scandal back during the Bush administration about U.S. attorneys who were fired for refusing to do what Comey did. And the Bush administration fired them. There was a huge scandal. I'm sure everybody remembers that, about that. That was the issue, was that the Bush administration wanted U.S. attorneys to interfere in elections. And they refused to do it and were fired for doing it. And now we had the head of the FBI, James Comey, a man who, I mean, I wrote about at the time, and a lot of people did, wondering what in the world Barack Obama was thinking in appointing him, because he had been, you know, despite his own sort of self-aggrandizing narrative about how he saved the day back in the Bush administration, which was bunk as well.
I should just remind people what you're talking about. He was supposedly he supposedly threw himself on John Ashcroft's body, essentially, when Gonzalez came to attempt to get Ashcroft to sign off on some warrantless wire tap program. We're not quite sure, I think, what exactly it was, but he supposedly threw himself in between the Bush officials and John Ashcroft in the hospital room.
Right. They raced across town. You know, I mean, it's a very thrilling story of the hero, James Comey, racing across town to save the Republic. And the truth was that it was just a technical matter. He didn't care that there was warrantless wiretapping. He just wanted the right, you know, T's to be crossed and the right I's to be dotted, because they went ahead and did it.
Right.
They changed their theory about why they could do it, and he was fine with that. So, you know, this his tale, in which he told in very dramatic fashion in a hearing years later. So we all heard about it and went, oh, gosh, you know, what a terrific guy James Comey is. But the truth is that he's always been a stalwart Republican partisan, although he claims now that he doesn't vote Republican, which I don't think that means anything. He was the deputy counsel of the Senate Whitewater Committee back in the 90s, Alphonse D'Amato's committee, which was completely out of control, and he was leaking like a sieve to the press. So there was plenty of reason for Obama to be concerned that this guy would be head of the FBI. And it's a 10-year term, and it's, you know, it's incredibly powerful. And the fact that he did this, that he actually interfered, you know, whether he did it for partisan reasons or he did it because he's a clod and didn't understand how, you know, going against the well-established norms in the Justice Department that you don't do it. Loretta Lynch evidently told him that she didn't think he should do it. Or whether or not he knew that his FBI agents were running out of control, which is probably part of it, because Rudy Giuliani was hinting around broadly that they were leaking information. Whether he was trying to cut them off at the pass, there is no excuse. Either he's a terrible manager and can't keep a hold of his agents, or he's too dumb to understand the political implications of what he's doing, or he's a partisan. Either way, he is absolutely, you know, guilty of doing something that was monumentally outrageous for anybody in the law enforcement community to do. And he is going to go down in history as, you know, somebody, you know, Harry Reid says he, you know, calls him J. Edgar Hoover. So there you go.
Well, we'll see about that because, you know, I guess a lot of that legacy will be determined by Trump's actions, right, where he places him. That may be. He may have more opportunity to do stuff like that. And let me just add two things. One is that one of my theories, too, as to why he did it may have been that he was just afraid of going in front of these Republican-controlled committees afterwards. And, you know, who could theoretically have slashed his funding and whatnot. I mean, I think they could have made his life a living hell, and maybe he thought it wouldn't have that implication on the election. But again, same, you're in the same place. This is a guy like you don't want this guy in charge of anything. And just to reiterate the policy, I spoke to a good friend of mine who was a former head of a public corruption division of a USA's office. And he said that when he first joined the Department of Justice, wasn't working in Washington, they had, as a rookie or whatever they call them, Comey actually gave a talk to them about the most important thing is that we have is our integrity and that we are seen as not getting involved specifically in elections, right? Because this is the public corruption thing. And he said, you never, ever, ever. It is just like, it is a blanket binary policy. If you are literally like 4 or 5 or 6 months out at least of an election, you just don't do it. You don't make any investigation public. You don't bring any charges, even if it's clear. You just don't do it because it is the most important thing is that you're not, like, the primary paramount is that you're not interfering with elections or seen to be. And this was about as naked of an interference with an election as you could possibly get, which is scary because, you know, what won't he do at that point?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's obviously, I mean, whether or not he did it as a blunder or whether or not he did it with purely partisan motives, I mean, the FBI is a tremendously powerful organization, and I mean, it is the national domestic intelligence organization, and the power that is vested in that agency. And I think there's good reason to believe that there was partisan activity going on within the FBI as well. I mean, certainly Trump partisans were saying that there were, and there's plenty of documents and documentation and evidence. You know, people who are very connected with the FBI. People, you know, there were people like Michael Flynn, Trump's new national security advisor, was going on TV saying he had friends in the FBI who were, quote, telling him things. Rudy Giuliani, various others. I mean, this idea that this national police force is operating on a partisan basis, you know, I mean, that there's nothing. I mean, the FBI has leaked for many years in many ways, and back in the 90s, they were certainly leaking on the Clinton, you know, investigations to certain favored members of the press. So it's not new necessarily, but in the hands of Donald Trump, it's very, you know, I mean, Trump is not like anyone else. I mean, he's the president. He has total control of the government at this point, or at least the Republicans do with him at the head. And a partisan police agency like the FBI and the rest of them, by the way, I mean, who all endorsed Trump, like, you know, the Fraternal Order of Police and the Immigration and Customs Service and, you know, all of the Border Patrol, all these police agencies endorsed him. This is getting, I mean, it makes you nervous. Let's just put it that way. This is not good. This is not good.
And to add, what is not good is this. I mean, just to pivot here a little bit, but in some respects, I don't know that we are. This whole private security force thing. This is the scariest thing in terms of the. And I'm trying to just organize my concerns about the Trump administration into silos, right? Just to keep it straight. The sort of the kleptocracy, which I think sort of overlaps a little bit with the authoritarianism in terms of encouraging it and growing it. And then just sort of the right-wing assault on our government, which is sort of a, I don't know, it shouldn't be a sideshow, but it's a separate silo. But this, the idea that he is keeping his own private security force, this I find terrifying. And it's unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, at least in modern times.
Totally. I mean, from the time the Secret Service was created, no president has ever done this. You know, I mean, it's bizarre, and it makes no sense for his own safety purposes either, because according to this came from an investigative piece that came out of the out of Politico this week, in which, you know, that he has a security chief who has hired a bunch of people, and they were with him on the campaign even after the Secret Service came on, which was early. Remember, it was like fall of 2015 that he got Secret Service protection. He and Ben Carson were the first two. It's abnormal. Normally, you let go of your private security if you've hired it as a politician or a candidate the minute the Secret Service comes on, and for good reason. They are the most highly trained protective service in the world, and you don't want interference with them, right? And in fact, there are stories that Trump's security guys being untrained. They're cops or ex-cops or ex-FBI agents, but they're not trained in this specific way, that they've actually kind of interfered at times with the protection of Trump. Like when there was a guy, I think it was in Arizona, that tried to jump the stage, and apparently one of Trump's security guys, his head guy, kind of got in the way of how they normally do it. I mean, luckily nothing happened, but that's disturbing. I mean, you know, the last thing we want is for anything to like that to happen to a President Trump. I wouldn't wish that ever in a million years, because God only knows what would happen then. It's horrible. So, you know, that is disturbing. And then the other side of it is, and this is what made me really kind of my stomach churn when I read about this security force is really there, apparently, to control dissent at gatherings where Trump is. In other words, protesters. And that has been their main job through the entire thing. And what they do is they wade into the crowd and they grab these people, and there's tons of footage of this, and kind of yank them around and drag them through the crowd, push them through the crowd, and the crowd, you know, spits at them and yells at them and does all the usual stuff. Well, you know, this is not normal. And the idea, all Trump has to do is kind of say, get him out of here. That's the line, right, that he uses. Get him out. Get him out. And these guys jump into action. You know, there are, I don't want to, you know, get too deeply into historical parallels here, but there is one big historical parallel that took place back in the 1930s where that same kind of protective service morphed into a major policing operation. And it became very, very dangerous for citizens. And, you know, Trump is planning to continue to hold rallies throughout his presidency. And in fact, he said just last week that this is how he plans to get the word out, is to hold rallies. So he's going to continue doing this and probably avoid the press. He's other than friendly interviewers who, you know, like Sean Hannity or something. And he'll tweet if he can. He'll have friendly interviewers, and he's going to hold these big rallies. And with these guys in there kind of controlling whatever happens at these rallies, and all of that is just chilling. That's not American. That's not how we do things here.
I'll tell you, my fears about that, and it's sort of like, you know, there's, you know, part of what is difficult about contemplating this stuff is sort of, you know, the classic Condi Rice failure of imagination type of yeah. scenario here, because, you know, and that's why I think it's easy. It's certainly easy to poo-poo, like, let's talk to a survivor of the Holocaust, or let's talk to someone who has studied the rise of you know, Mussolini or something, because people think, oh, you're getting a little bit carried away. But the problem is, like, we don't know what we don't know. And you know, I'm going back through all the Bush administration figures here for sayings, but one of the things that scares me about this, like, private security forces is not just that they're going to manhandle people at rallies. Like, what's going to stop one of these guys, the head of it, or any of them, from going into various agencies and just saying, like, I want this guy's license plate run, and I want a phone tap put on him, and you're not going to monitor it. I'm going to monitor it. I mean, what's to stop these guys who now, you know, obviously they felt the authority in these rallies, right? But they're working for the campaign and the candidate. Well, now they're working directly for the president. There is yep. no check. There is no, and you're not going to have guys on this force who are, you know, who joined, you know, you're not going to have that guy from Ohio who's like, I'm red, white, and blue and apple pie, and I'm going to join the force to serve the Constitution. And, oh, my God, I can't believe the abuse I'm seeing here. I'm going to go and tell the inspector general. There's no guys like that on this force, right? I mean, these are all mercenaries who have been hired to be mercenaries. And they're not going to be bound by anything other than direct loyalty to Trump. And you know Trump, it's going to go both ways with this guy, right? I mean, there's not going to ever be a situation where the head of the Secret Service goes to the chief of staff, you know, to Reince Priebus and says, like, I got to talk to the president because this is out of hand. They're going to just say, go back to your office. I mean, there's no check on this. There's no short circuits.
Absolutely not. I mean, there's no short circuit. There's no oversight. It's reminiscent of the situation with the Iraq War contractors, Eric Prince and Blackwater. Those guys, there was no legal framework in Iraq to really deal with them, recall? I mean, it was yep. like they could do anything. They didn't fall under the military code of justice, and they were exempt from the local laws, and, you know, I mean, it's one of those things. It's kind of an extrajudicial security force. And, you know, and think about this. I mean, here's another little extra added thing for your nightmares. I just read this interview with Richard Branson, who knows Trump and has met him several times, and he just did this little recollection. It was a few paragraphs long of having lunch with Trump, and all Trump talked about was how he wanted to get revenge on five people in his life who had done him wrong. I mean, this was like the sum total of the conversation. He was filled with vengeance. And Branson said to him, you know, this is going to eat you alive. You really can't do it. And he just, you know, he refused to even accept that. And it reminded me of that one of the first talks that Trump gave to, of all places, Liberty University, which was a couple of, well, actually, I think it was in 2014. So it was like 3 years ago. almost. And he spoke with Liberty University before we knew he was running for president. And that was the message that he gave those nice Christian students, was about, you know, revenge is sweet. And, you know, that's the most important thing, is to get revenge. It's interesting. People should look that up, because it kind of sent chills down my spine when I first read it, which was, you know, like 15, 16 months ago. So, you know, imagine that. You've got Trump. He's got his own private security force. He's got, you know, unaccountable to anyone. He has, you know, if you were counting on, say, the deep state, NSA or CIA, who seem to be, at least the analytical side of the CIA seems a little bit leery about Trump. I don't know about the covert side. They seem, I'm sure they like him fine. They like torturers and overthrowers and people like that. But on the analytical side, which is generally a bunch of nerds sitting around looking at data, those guys, they might resist him. But this security force, if they have the same capabilities, or at least the ability to go and demand certain things,
right?
I mean, you just don't know what will happen. And by the way, you know, let's not count on James Comey, right? I mean, is James Comey's FBI going to be our bulwark against Trump excess? I don't know.
This is very, very scary stuff. And you're right. I mean, there's plenty of examples of him talking about this revenge thing. And I would add, just to sort of add another overlay of lack of accountability, at the very least, you know, as much as Blackwater was basically unaccountable through any procedures, someone at the end of the day was paying them, right? And theoretically, at one point, there could have been pressure on that person, like, stop paying them. Like, just stop paying them. End the contract. There's no one in that scenario here. It's Trump. There's no one who's ever going to say, stop paying this force. And, you know, it's scary. I keep waiting for someone to just show up. And I think that's why, you know, there was, I mean, I wasn't terribly surprised about the way Obama spoke the other day in his press conference about Russia. But there's a lot of people who don't follow politics who I think were like, what the heck is going on? Where's, you know, everybody's sort of waiting for like daddy to show up and say, hey, all right, enough of this. Everybody, we had fun. Donald,
okay,
please disband your thing. If you want to sit at the table, you've got to, you know, put your pants on or whatever it is. And there's no one showing up to say this. And, you know, certainly Barack Obama, I think, in many ways revealed, and maybe, you know, this is a conversation we could have in a couple of weeks in terms of his legacy, but certainly I think the past, you know, the whole Comey thing and the Russia thing, I think coupled with the fact that Donald Trump appears to be primed to reverse everything, and Donald Trump, and I should say the Republicans, everything that he has achieved, I think is going to, it's not going to leave him much of a legacy, it seems to me, but maybe that's a little bit off point, but do you have a sense of that as well, or no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, he must be beyond devastated that this person in the hands, I mean, let's not forget one important aspect of Donald Trump's presidency. He has become president largely due to the fact that the Republican Party was already having a nervous breakdown. They were at peak crazy before Donald Trump came on the
yep.
scene, right? I mean, they have been building up to, you know, a complete and utter meltdown, which is what we were assuming was going to happen, right? The Democrats would win the election, excuse me, potentially take over the Senate. We thought there was a good chance that would happen, and their repudiation of the party would lead to them finally recognizing just how crazy they've been and that they have to moderate. And, I mean, this was just kind of a given among a lot of liberals that this was the end of
the fever's
going to
break.
Race.
The fever will finally break.
Yes, it will
right?
finally break, and they will understand how, you know, how they've gone too far, and they're going to reevaluate, and they're going to come back and reconstruct themselves as a normal, hopefully, opposition party. Well, I'm afraid that did not happen. If anything, they have been rewarded
They've been totally rewarded. And, you know, honestly, that fever will break theory. You can go back. I know you can. It's probably all on your blog, frankly, at Hullabaloo. Yeah. But you can look 2 months before 2009, the 2010 election. You can look a week after the 2010 election. You can look 2 months before the 2012 election. You can look a week after the 2012 election. You do the same thing with 2014. Every time Obama himself is saying some variant of the fever's going to break. Yep. And if they won, they were like, well, I think now that they have power, they're going to realize that they can do stuff and that it's on them. And they're going to, and he more than anything was this guy's fatal flaw. And yep. It also, I think, is just sort of, I don't know that it was just tactical. It may have been tactical for his advisors, strategic for his advisors, but I think for him, that's who he is, right? Like he sort of ideologically or unideologically, his ideology was always sort of process in some way. I mean, it was quite obvious insofar as like, you know, how could a guy with big ears and a name like Barack Hussein Obama be president? Well, of course, because of the process. And you don't succeed in that process and then turn around and say, hey, something's broken here. Right. Because then all of a sudden you start to question why you're there in the first place. But I want to pivot from that because I think, you know, that's a conversation we can have maybe in a month or so.
Yeah.
As he's exiting. I want to talk about the way the press is covering this because, you know, memories of the Bush era is coming back to me now. And when we're going on vacation next week and we're doing some deep archive shows, there's a whole set of shows that have now become more relevant. So, you know, Matt was like, we got Lewis Lapham talking about fascism for next week's members shows. And I'm like, I remember that now. And it was never something that I would have played had Hillary Clinton won the election, because that's, but now we're back in that saddle. And I'm curious what your perspective is on how the media is covering, because I have some real sharp critiques, I think, of just even how we covered Bush back then in retrospect.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I think that you and I both kind of started off in this particular, you know, era. I mean, we were around before, but, you know, going back to the Bush years when we kind of, became sort of, you know, publicly speaking out on this sort of stuff. The media critique was always central and for a good reason. They seem to be incapable of meeting this sort of challenge as journalists without, you know, first of all, even if they have any sense that they have gone off the rails, they seem incapable of doing the kind of analysis that would bring them to some kind of a change. I mean, you see little bits of it around. There are certain people, of course, I don't mean to paint it with such a broad brush that there's nobody in the media who thinks about this stuff. But the fact that it's happening again in the face of we saw it happen with the Bush administration, certainly going the entire last few years of the Clinton administration with the impeachment and the way that the media behaved then was absolutely abominable. Going into the 2000 election, which was a dubious result at best, and then of course the biggie was the Iraq War, and the lead up to that was absolutely mindless. The media has shown, throughout this sort of modern era, in the face of what I would call the great propaganda push on the right, which you can probably attribute to the rise of Newt Gingrich, I would say, in the late 80s, early 90s, that, you know, they do not have an ability to resist this. They seem to be kind of like, they're like children. They're offered, all this candy, and they can't seem to stop themselves from taking it. And now we're back in that situation. I mean, during the Obama years, and frankly, the media, I think, was pretty friendly to Obama for the most part. I think they liked him personally, and mm-hmm. I think that he didn't offer them, you know, I think the right was discombobulated. They didn't have the right tools to be able to fight Obama on this kind of media scandal level. So, you know, now we're back there, and the campaign, you know, with all the, I mean, we are doing autopsy after autopsy after autopsy of this election campaign, because it is, and it needs to be done, because it was unique, and we've never seen a campaign like this, and largely due to Donald Trump, because he is, you know, such a, he's sui generis. He's not a politician. He's a celebrity. And he won, you know, largely, I think, on the basis of that. And the media of all these groups, whether it's, you know, I mean, they are absolutely incapable of accepting their own responsibility for what happened there. And yet it is obvious that they contributed mightily, whether or not it was their, you know, intense focus on, you know, Clinton's alleged misdeeds with her email server, or whether it was this unbelievable amount of time they gave to Donald Trump for free to just spout his stuff off to, you know, millions of Americans who obviously saw him already as a TV star, and they just sort of added to that glow of celebrity by putting him on TV and letting him ramble for hours. And then putting his supporters on, CNN did this, the other network didn't, but, well, Fox just was what it was. But CNN hired all these supporters to just sit there and spout talking points hour after hour after hour without any kind of conservative, and there were plenty of conservative critics of Donald Trump, but they were given very little airtime.
But I mean, all that's true about the election, but I don't want to spend too much time on that because I'm not convinced, you know, I'm not convinced that in the places where it made a difference, that those people are watching that much cable television.
Maybe not.
I mean, there's, you know, cable television, when it does good, maybe 10 million people watch it. And it creates, I'd certainly agree and have to feel this, otherwise I might as well just go home, that it creates a certain narrative, but I'm not convinced at how much of the implications of this have on an election of this magnitude. I mean, certainly, like, you know, local elections can be more swung by media, but I think that I have come to believe that much of what people like you and I do have more impact on legislative fights because that's much more self-contained. You know, you're talking like, you know, the number of people who are engaged in a legislative fight who watch cable news, there's a much higher ratio there than the people in rural Wisconsin who are going to win that election, or frankly, downtown Milwaukee, who are going to go out and vote. I mean, I just don't think that there's that, you know, that cable news in particular has that type of impact on the election. I mean, I think there was other failings, but now that he's elected, I mean, let me tell you what I'm getting at here with what he's elected and what, as I reflect on the Bush years. I watched last night, and it was late because they rerun, and I'm not singling out Joy Reid, it's just I happened to be watching her. She was filling in for Chris Matthews. And the first segment was about, I was barely half watching it, but it was about Bill Clinton apparently had tweeted out something or had given an interview saying that Donald Trump doesn't know anything about anything and he got the working class white voters. And then Trump came out with a tweet saying, well, he called me as opposed to I called him. And there was like 15 minutes of this. And I'm thinking to myself, this can't be the top story. It can't be. It's not worthy. It's not like there's so much news about what's happening with the Trump administration in terms of, and like I say, any of those silos, the kleptocracy, the appointments to the cabinet, what's going to happen to Medicare, what's going to happen to Social Security. There is, and this is ostensibly like the biggest voice, right, as it stands now, that is like focused on dissent, theoretically, right, is MSNBC. I don't know if it's going to stay that way. I don't know. You know, I'm not saying they're a perfect messenger by any means, but focusing on the individual and his psychological issues, it seems to me, is how that election was lost, right? There was no engagement on the implications of policy where it impacts everybody. And that, to me, I feel like during the Bush years, there was a lot of like, you know, he's Shrub, not Bush. Well, that's funny, but I don't think that's going to really tell the story. It wasn't until people started talking about substantive things that he was going to do. He's going to take away your Social Security. Oh, well, in that case, these guys are horribly corrupt. They're hiding a potential sexual predator amongst Congress. I mean, those type of things are, it seems to me, have a lot more salience than Donald Trump is, he's crazy. I worry about, I worry about that. And I wonder if this time around, as we construct the vehicles for dissent, I think we're better situated for it to be about policy, it seems to me. And I don't mean in a dry sense, but in just, you know, it's pretty vivid. Like, a lot of people are going to lose their health insurance. I hope you're not sick, because if you are, you're going to lose your health insurance. These type of things seem to be pretty ripe for the taking. Now, maybe it's just because he's not even president yet that you can't talk about this stuff, but it seems like there's a lot to talk about.
Oh, I agree. And I think, you know, look, if there's one thing that I think we can be sure of, it's that talking about the general indecency of Donald Trump, a lot of people in this country, half of voters almost, don't care. I mean, I think we saw that in the campaign. I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign was an appeal to the decency of the average American.
Yeah.
And, you know, the majority voted against him. And I think largely on that basis, they didn't like what they saw. He's a crude, disgusting human being, and we know that. And he's not very intelligent, and he's got a violent streak. And, you know, there are a million things about him that we all know. And her campaign was showing, and I think they probably, you know, we'll read books about this later, probably showed in focus groups that people were appalled when they saw the stuff that he said and went, oh, my God. It didn't matter in the end. There were enough votes in the right places to make him president anyway, which means that, you know, I don't know, some 62 million people voted for him. That's a lot of people. So I'm going to guess that's not going to win it. That's not going to change things for us. That is factored in. Everybody knows that Donald Trump is an indecent piece of work. And he's president anyway, and a lot of people don't care about that. So you're right. I mean, it has to refocus itself outwards on what is having this indecent person, how does that affect me?
Right.
How does this indecent piece of work being in the White House affect me? And you know, I think, frankly, I'm assuming, because he is the person that he is, that he's going to show us in some fairly obvious ways how his indecency will play out as a person. And so it may be one of those things where you don't have to say it. It's just kind of, let's assume we all know that Donald Trump is an indecent piece of work. Let's look at how that plays out for us. And that will be, it, you know, repeal of Obamacare. It'll be, the corruption. I think that over time, I think that sinks in when people start seeing. And this is where the news media really has, you know, if they can do as good a job on revealing Donald Trump's corruption and conflicts of interest as they did on Hillary Clinton's emails. Granted, the corruption story is much more complicated and will require more of their journalistic talents to tell that story. But over time, if they tell it right, people will begin to understand that this guy is actually running a business out of the White House for his own benefit. And frankly, I think he believes his family will be far, far more wealthy at the end of his reign in office than they were when they went in.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's part of his plan. And I think that he sees nothing wrong with that. And what he believes, I'm to give him the benefit of the doubt here. I think he believes that whatever is good for Donald Trump and the Trump organization and his kids is good for the USA. That is what they have to keep focusing on as far as his character stuff. And then the rest, of course, is all about what's he doing to you, you know, and there's lots.
And I think on that last one, you know, I think like Rex Tillerson, he's one of those guys who also feels like if I'm making money, America's making money. If I'm doing good, America's doing good, or what is really important about America is doing good. And and it would be certainly consistent with the way that Donald Trump had made money up to this point. You know, when he wasn't branding, and when it wasn't just exclusively about branding, you know, creating this image, it was leveraging government to make money. You know, I mean, that's what it was, getting funds, getting sweetheart deals. And I think that is the mentality.
He admitted it publicly.
Sure.
He admitted it. He always said, hey, you know, I bought off politicians. Sure I did, because I'm smart. You know, I don't pay taxes because I'm smart. I mean, that's what he said. So,
that's what, I think there's, you know, and people who live in small towns, I think, understand this more than anything else. Like, you know, the town selectmen, they generally, you know, run businesses that end up getting some real value out of their being in office. And, you know, and some level that microcosm is just, it's scalable. And I think he's scaled it, but we will talk more about this in the sadly, the coming months, the coming years. Here we go again, Digby.
Here we go again. Good God, I didn't think we'd be here again, but
no,
here we are.
We're a long cry from complaining about Barack Obama's plan to cut Social Security.
Oh, we were so innocent then.
Yes, the good old days.
The good old days.
Well, I hope to talk to you again in January when we can talk about Obama's legacy and then move forward and talk about the new legacy that's being created for what was formerly the United States of America. I don't know. We'll see.
Absolutely.
Have a great holiday. Happy New Year. And we'll see you in 2017.
You too, Sam. You too.
Oh, talk wait a second. Hold on. I want to tell people that you are having a fundraiser right now. And just say, I mean, I think people who have listened to this program for any length of time know that you are my favorite blogger and that I think you do a tremendous service for all of us. And I know that people are going to be looking towards that service more and more in the coming years. So people should head over to your site at Digby's blog. What is it, hullabaloo.com or digbysblog.com?
It's digbysblog.com. And just Google Digby and it'll come up. Digby hullabaloo and you'll get it.
All right. Thanks,
Heather. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Really, folks, head over there. It is... blogging is a tough road to hoe, and we don't have many bloggers from that era anymore. People who are independent, who are not working for news organizations or magazines, or have moved on to create empires that, you know, are more about how many clicks have we gotten? Well, we've got to up X, Y, and Z. It is people who rely primarily on its readership to support their work they do. So by all means, do that, because, you know, and part of the work that she does is goes on programs like mine and helps us understand these things better. So please, if you can support her, do. And after you do that, if you find like, oh, I've got all this extra change in my pocket, maybe I'll become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. I'll go to jointhemajorityreport.com. I'll take this change in my pocket. I will shove it into my computer on a daily basis. Also, we have an ability for you to give a gift of the Majority Report. Go to majoritygift.com. You don't have to wait for it to be shipped. You don't have to like, oh my God, I'm going to wrap this. No, ladies and gentlemen, you can get that gift. You can buy that gift. Like, oh my God, the kids are coming down to get, check their stockings. We forgot to get them presents. What will we get them? I know. There's nothing like young children like more than a membership to the Majority Report. Then they go, where are my gifts? And you go, look on your computer. Check your email. It's right there. I bought it at majoritygift.com.
We could start packaging some of these segments as like scary stories for kids.
That is kind of brilliant and civically minded and really disturbing at the same time, Matt. Which actually could describe a lot of your commentary.
Is that like Black Mirror? Is that what is that name of that show, Black Mirror?
That yeah, does we're seem sort like a kind of Black Mirror-ish like a, idea.
Well, this show is just basically turning into like just a more literal Black Mirror. That's all.
Black Mirror not, news.
We're not going to go. Yeah, exactly. We're not going to
go. Black Mirror is turning into a more literal.
Well, but we're just not using a narrative. We're just
do you remember the storyline in that show that happened to overlap somewhat with a very disturbing story that came out about David Cameron?
No, I haven't seen all
well,
of it.
Okay,
I've only
well,
seen
I
a couple
spoil
episodes.
It,
don't
but
spoil
it. Was
it.
Just one
hear.
Of those things where it was like, how is this happening?
I don't want to speak. I don't want to hear.
Do you still have that drop, Matt?
Oh. Wait, you don't think Majority Gift is correct?
It's majority.fans.fm.
No, it's majoritygift.com.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you get it. I've set that up. Majoritygift.com.
There's also other ones which are totally tasteless and we in no way condone.
You're going to have to go onto Twitter and find those.
Yeah.
Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Here's what's going to happen, folks, over the next 2 days. We're going to do our final live show tomorrow. We will take calls and we're just going to freewheel it. And we'll pre-record a final show for Friday with Cliff Schechter and with Matthew Film Guy and Isabel Gillies to do the final live show of the year.
They're going to be debating Syria.
Let me tell you something.
Isabel and Matthew.
One other reason to become a member is some of the archive shows, like we were talking about. Lewis Lapham on fascism. What else you got for us? Just don't tell it all, Matt. Don't just give a little tease.
Helen Thomas.
Helen Thomas. The famous, she was an AP reporter.
Press Corps.
And to press corps under Bush. And more, ladies and gentlemen. Oh,
did
so
she go
much
back
more.
To Kennedy?
She was there for a long time. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun app. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. You can IM the show. We'll be right back.